This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is the 20th of August, and I'm Inez. I'm in the studio with Kate and Priya. How are you both?
I am doing pretty good this week. I actually had a food mystery. Not as interesting as your cereal.
No, go on. What's your food mystery?
So we went for a walk over the weekend, my partner and I, and we came back and there was a mystery tomato sauce sachet just sitting in the middle of the kitchen floor. And it wasn't there when we left.
Do you have a pet?
Yes. Do you know what, though? My brilliant mind did not go to that as a first option. I was like, there's just a tomato sauce fairy that thinks we don't have enough tomato sauce in our life. And they've snuck in while we're out and left us to treat.
It's a scurvy fairy that's come through for you guys. So I would say check your vitamin C levels.
I will go and do that immediately after the show. Oh.
Yeah, I'm keeping on. It's a busy time. It seems like Every moment where I'm like, oh, I could take a breather. I can't.
Yes.
Don't breathe, guys.
Don't breathe. Let's keep it together.
Yes.
Who needs a lung?
We all do.
We all do. We need two, in fact.
We need two.
That's why we tend to have two.
Double trouble.
Okay.
Should we talk about
what we've got on?
Almost quadruple trouble with all the segments. What's happening first?
So we will first hear, as part of our AI breakfast special this week, we're listening to part one of a six-part project being developed by two of our very own 3CR hosts based upon Radical Literature's A Booklet About Artificial Intelligence. Now, this piece is written by the AI Safety Symposium and provides a deep dive into the question, what is AI?
Amazing. This is a cool theme, I think, the AI breakfast specials, because I feel like it's doing a lot of work to demystify things and provide a lot of different critical perspectives. I think it's happening across breakfast shows as well, so I encourage people to stay tuned in. And after that, we will be joined by Gina Martin, who is a gender equality advocate, writer, and facilitator. And Gina's joining us for a critical conversation about the privacy and gendered implications of a rise in wearable surveillance tech, including via Kmart's new Anko brand camera glasses, which she has started a wildly successful petition to get removed from Kmart's shelves.
Yeah, pretty gross that was they almost sold out and there were lines out the door.
They sold out immediately and they were priced at $89 each. So a lot of people are getting them.
Yucky. Speaking of activism, we have Ben McLeod, Senior Advisor at the Climate Council, who joins me to unpack how we need to shield households from data center bills and pollution. Now, there's real concerns around the sheer amount of electricity that they use and the need for them to be powered by renewable energy. Otherwise, they really push up people's electricity bills. And we'll be talking kind of in the context of the new New South Wales laws.
And also as part of our AI breakfast special this week, we will speak with Associate Professor of Social Work at ACU, Jessica Rus-Smith, a sovereign Wiradjuri Wambul woman from the Smith and Guinness Wiradjuri Matriarchy. Her work focuses on the embodiment of First Nations sovereignty and critical anti-colonial practice. Now, Jess co-authored the groundbreaking 2024 book, The AI Revolution, Valuing Country, Culture and Community in a World of Algorithms. It challenges dominant narratives about artificial intelligence by centering First Nations sovereignty, and we will speak with Jess about what the current harms of the AI transformation are on country, climate and social justice, the issue of data sovereignty, and ways in which we can reconceptualize AI using First Nations people's ways of knowing and being with technology.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we have a really packed show as usual, so you want to keep tuned. before the headlines that are coming up real soon. Speak to you soon.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:05 in the morning, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 20th of August. The federal government's National Disability Insurance Scheme has passed the Senate with coalition support this week, despite clear and fierce opposition from disability communities. After an inquiry that lasted more than 9 weeks and included over 4,500 submissions, the vast majority of which opposed the bill, the only recommendation made by the committee was for the Senate to pass the bill. As a result, the Labor government will cut an estimated $38 billion from the NDIS and block more than 300,000 people from accessing funding and support. Greens Senator Jordan Steele John said in a statement that, quote, "We know that this bill will cost tens of thousands of jobs and strip away rights and protections that have been the difference between life and death. People with disabilities and their carers now face a lack of clarity and transparency with changes, with some cuts due to begin in October. But people with disability and disabled communities have vowed to continue fighting and organizing against the implementation of the bill and the significantly increased risks and harms that it will cause."
Also in headlines, the federal government is planning to restart welfare payment suspensions and cancellations under the targeted compliance framework from October, despite previous findings that the system is unlawful. The Anti-Poverty Centre says the penalties deepen poverty and disproportionately harm First Nations people, with Ombudsman investigations finding more than 300,000 people may have been affected by unlawful payment cancellations.
And finally in headlines, the Palestinian National Initiative says the Israeli government is leveraging settler violence to advance its goals of annexing the occupied West Bank and move from apartheid to ethnically cleansing the territory. The Israeli government is reportedly imposing a new law assigning civilian law enforcement powers to Israeli police, meaning Israelis who live in the occupied territories illegally are subject to Israeli law, while Palestinians are subject to military law. This comes amongst ongoing settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank and continued Israeli drone strikes in Gaza in blatant violations of the so-called ceasefire. This includes an attack on a cafe in Gaza City's port area this week that killed at least 7 Palestinians and injured many more, and a drone strike in central Gaza City yesterday that killed at least 6 people. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 20th of August, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing, and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics, and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
Hello, you are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855. And now for our first segment, we are going to do a deep dive into the question, what is AI? We're going to listen to a recording that's part of an AI breakfast special this week. So we listened to part one of a 6-part project being developed by 2 of our very own 3CR hosts based upon Radical Literature's A Booklet About Artificial Intelligence, written by the AI Safety Symposium. So without further ado.
A booklet about artificial intelligence. Our worst-case scenario may not include some unknown unknowns. Edition 1, version 5, June 2026. This booklet was written on the continent of Australia by the AI Safety Symposium and first printed in February 2025. Introduction. Well, what the hell is this little pickle we've landed in? We have entered the spring blossoming of artificial intelligence, or AI. Its recent explosion over the past few years is rapidly changing the world as we know it. We think there is cause for alarm and it should be taken very seriously by everyone. We'll be straight up. We think AI is a big problem. This is a booklet about why it is a big problem. We'll cover a brief history of its development, how it works, hint, nobody really knows, and who's driving it. If this booklet has found its way into your hands, it is already outdated due to the rapid and daily change of AI development. If you see an older version of this booklet, older than version 5, throw it out. It's outdated, probably has errors, and is superseded by this version. We encourage readers to seek out your own information beyond this booklet. This is a super dense topic, and it can be overwhelming or perhaps unbelievable. We encourage you to take your time to digest the information and have some trusted people to chat with. Okay, now that's settled, let's begin. AI. What is it? AI, artificial intelligence, in its broadest sense, is intelligence exhibited by machines, particularly computer systems. It is technology that enables computers and machines to simulate human learning, comprehension, problem-solving, decision-making, creativity, and autonomy. These systems can learn from new information and experience. The majority of AI programs are not a code-based computer program written by humans. This is explained more later on. Below are three broad categories of AI. There is currently no unified clear definition for these three categories yet. However, we have tried to explain each one below. The three types of artificial intelligence. Artificial narrow intelligence, ANI. Stage 1, machine learning. Specializes in one area and solves one problem. Artificial general intelligence, AGI. Stage 2, machine intelligence. Refers to a computer that is as smart as a human across the board. Artificial superintelligence, ASI. Stage 3, machine consciousness. An intellect that is much smarter than the best human brains in practically every field. Narrow AI, also known as weak AI, artificial narrow intelligence, or ANI, or narrow AI, refers to AI systems that are designed to perform a specific task or set of closely related tasks. It operates under a narrow set of rules and cannot exhibit the same level of understanding or adaptability as a human. Narrow AI is the most common form of AI that we encounter today. It is programmed to perform singular tasks such as AI chatbot, facial recognition, creating art and content, language translation, data analysis, playing chess, and increasingly, many basic capitalist tasks. It does so with proficiency, often surpassing human capability. However, it lacks the ability to apply knowledge to different contexts beyond its specific intention. For example, a narrow AI designed to identify shoplifters will not be able to generate an AI image and vice versa. Artificial general intelligence, or AGI, is a type of artificial intelligence that matches or surpasses the average human cognitive capabilities across a wide range of cognitive tasks. This is different from narrow AI, which is limited to specific tasks. Developing AGI is one of the primary objectives of AI research and of the biggest companies in the world, such as Google, Alphabet, OpenAI, Microsoft, Meta, and many more. Many AI experts believe that this will possibly be achieved within the next year or two. ASI, artificial superintelligence, is a theoretical point in the development of AI systems with an intellectual scope beyond all human intelligence in all domains. Once AGI is developed, experts believe it is highly likely that artificial superintelligence, or ASI, will shortly follow, due to AGI agents being self-learning and integrated into the development process. This point in time is often referred to as singularity. Many experts believe this could happen in the next 10 years, or maybe sooner. OpenAI's 5 steps to artificial general intelligence. Level 1, chatbots. AI with natural conversation language abilities. Level 2, reasoners. AIs with human levels of problem solving across a broad range of topics. Level 3, agents. AI systems that can take actions independently or from human instruction. Level 4, innovators. AI that can aid in the invention of new ideas and contribute to human knowledge. Level 5, organizations. AI that is capable of doing all of the work of an organization independently. Asterisk. LLM reasoners level 2 have been released. See OpenAI's O1 and DeepSeek's R1. There are many examples of agents level 3 that demonstrate agentic capabilities, but as of yet, there are not autonomous independent systems. How AI works. The system that drives AI are very different to traditional computer programming. Traditional computer software is coded line by line by programmers who need to understand broadly how the program works. In contrast, modern AI models are developed using algorithms and deep learning, a technique that feeds the AI huge amounts of data to train them to recognize patterns and make predictions. This is called an AI training run. It uses hardware called GPUs to train on this data for several weeks or months until the AI is at a point where it creates its neural network. A digital neural network is essentially a large matrix of billions of numbers that encodes a program. These neural networks are essentially trying to mimic the neural network of a human brain. The majority of the AI systems are developed by itself. The capabilities of the AI is growing, in the sense that they are not built deliberately into this model by programmers, but rather emerge from patterns in large amounts of data. This results in the programmers having extremely limited understanding of how or why these systems work. This presents two significant consequences. We don't need understanding to grow powerful AI. Deep learning unlocked the current AI scaling paradigm, in which AI progress is constrained by resources rather than insights. Programmers don't need to come up with clever new solutions themselves. Instead, they can use the same deep learning algorithms over and over, simply feeding in more high-quality data to larger systems. We don't need to understand powerful AI. Today, we are building AI systems that we do not fundamentally understand and cannot predict the capabilities of, a complete divergence from how all other code is written by and legible to developers. This has so far been a brief summary due to the complex nature of AI systems. The next chapter, we'll try to explain the process of how they created an AI in more detail, for those who are interested. Due to its density, feel free to skip to the next chapter, unpredictability and emergence, and potentially come back here when you're ready for a deeper dive. How did they create AI? So if it isn't traditional computer program, what is it? And how did they create it? What's going on under the hood? Well, the specific thing is called an LLM, or a large language model. Programs are usually written in a computer language by humans, traditionally called code. There's HTML that makes up a website, there's JavaScript, there's C++ and Python. Computer code is made up of lines of code, each having small functions. They are arranged in a logical sequence and when run on a computer within a program, automatically perform a complex task. For example, a simple calculator might have a few hundred lines of code. A typical web application could have several thousand lines of code. And a video game could have hundreds of thousands or even millions of lines of code. How many lines of human code are written for leading LLM AI models right now? Approximately 300 lines of Python are used for one of the most advanced AI neural networks at the moment, called Llama. Yep, a few hundred lines. Similar goes for ChatGPT and the rest. Most modern AI have a few hundred lines of traditional computer code. Just to help that sink in, some of the most advanced AI at the moment contain some of the smallest amount of written code for a computer program, equal to a simple calculator app. How is this so? In 2017, a research paper was written by a group of computer scientists called "Attention is All You Need." This paper explained how through a very small amount of code, all you needed was to write a small but unique program called a transformer. This transformer was a logical sequence algorithm that created something like a flowchart of sorts to help an LLM AI understand human language. The transformer's main function is to interpret written language and predict the next word, technically called a token. That is its main function. The code tells AI to interpret what words it needs to pay attention to, which words to prioritize and analyze in order to predict the next word. In a nutshell, that's the main function of a transformer, and it can be done in less than a couple hundred lines of code. There are some other lines of code in the AI, like simple lines of code to help you write a question to input into the AI, and some code to help the AI to spit out the answer on the screen that it's thinking about. But essentially, there isn't a huge amount of code for any fundamental things going on. Neural networks. But it doesn't really do anything if it hasn't learnt anything. The AI needs to learn. It needs data to help it analyse and assess the patterns. That's where digital neural networks are used to achieve this. Researchers that studied neural networks in real brains came up with a theory of creating a digital neural network for AI. They wanted to see if it could digitally simulate the neural layers of our brains in a digital matrix. To visualize this, imagine eight circles representing the input layer. The next layer, hidden layer 1, containing 9 circles, which connect through pathways from the input layer. Following that, there's another hidden layer 2, also containing 9 circles, connecting that of hidden layer 1 via pathways, followed by hidden layer 3 in the same process. This ends with the output layer, represented by 4 circles. These are connected via the pathways to the input layer, channeling through the circles in hidden layer 1, 2, and 3. Each layer is made up of many neural nodes, which are represented by the circles, which each hold very basic information. This information is called a weight. You can refer to the diagram on page 7 of the booklet. The input words or tokens go through each of the hidden layers, which then creates many incalculable combinations of paths. Each path takes a different combination of neural nodes heading to the output layer, which begins to form the answers we see on the screen. Each node contains a different weight. Each weight simply holds a value, a number between 0 and 1, like 0.153, for example. If this currently all seems strange and confusing, no problem. It's confusing for everyone. But let's keep going. The last image of the neural network contains 3 hidden layers, and each layer contains 9 nodes, creating 27 hidden nodes in total, also called parameters. The different combinations of pathways for the data to travel along are also represented by each line in the image above. Within these layers and within these nodes are the weight values, and it's worth noting that each single numerical weight value isn't written by humans. This is where the concept of training the AI comes in. The way these weights are created start with vast amounts of data, and currently most of this data comes from the internet. The AI uses its neural network and transformer to continually interpret and learn from the data. All of humanity's conversations, every book, every document loaded on the internet, it trains on it and starts to learn to assign weights and parameters within its neural layers. The AI trains on the data and creates the weights or parameters by itself. Rather than written by humans in code, it's closer to the AI growing itself. By the end of its training run, the AI has grown much more than the 3 hidden layers, with a total of 27 nodes or parameters, such as in the diagram. By the end of a typical training run, most of these top-of-the-line AI have grown their neural networks to roughly 120 hidden neural layers, with roughly 1.8 trillion nodes or parameters. The different combinations of pathways for the data to travel through, all those 120 layers and 1.8 trillion nodes, are an almost incomprehensible amount of combinations for the human mind to understand.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
And you just listened to part one of a six-part project that's being developed by two of our very own 3CR hosts. Now, I understand we're being a bit mysterious in how we announce that. But, however, stay tuned because more details are coming and also more segments are coming. Now, we played that as part of our A Breakfast AI special this week where we dive into various topics about AI, which we also have another segment later in the show. However, what you just listened to was a piece based upon Radical Literature's A Booklet About Artificial Intelligence, written by the AI Safety Symposium, and the piece took a bit of a deep dive into the question, what is AI, even though it sort of admitted that no one really knows what the answer to that question is. However, very interesting nonetheless and enlightening. And stay tuned for our next segment in the show.
Join the Homeless Persons Union Victoria on our new radio show on the mighty 3CR.
Listen in as we embark on a public experiment to grow a homelessness union from the grassroots and on the radio.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a new monthly show on 3CR that seeks to grow a homelessness union in public view and to a wide audience.
We'll speak to people involved in community development, to allies, activists, and anyone who has anything interesting to say about homelessness issues in Melbourne today. Most importantly, we will centre the voices of people who are homeless in Melbourne and beyond.
Featuring interviews, guests, as well as analysis of policy, laws and media discourse that affect the homeless community.
Tune in on 3CR, 855am on Tuesday, September the 8th, 12am to 1am for our premier broadcast.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a proud affiliate show of 3CR.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass instruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis. Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided, or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Safe Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:30 in the morning right now, and we are joined by multi-award winning gender equality advocate, writer and facilitator Gina Martin for a critical conversation about the privacy and gendered implications of a rise in wearable surveillance technology, including via Kmart's new Anko brand camera glasses. Now, Gina recently launched a petition demanding that the Kmart Group Managing Director, Alexandra Spaseska, take immediate action to remove these glasses from store shelves. And the petition has now reached over 54,000 signatures, which signals a strong public desire to get rid of the glasses for good due to privacy concerns after they sold out almost immediately upon their launch last month. Good morning, Gina. Thank you very much for making the time this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate being able to have this chat with you. And I wanted to begin by asking about the launch of the Anko brand camera glasses and kind of how we got to a point where covert surveillance technologies become such an easily accessible consumer good.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think when we answer that question, we often kind of track the development of this technology through social media. We talk about Meta, we talk about wearable tech, Google Glass, which was launched, you know, a decade ago and ended up being pulled from the shelves. But I think if we want to be really honest, we have to say that we got to this point because Silicon Valley and the powerful men that run it over decades have been on a mission to create and scale surveillance technology and data collection for the state, but they have really encroached into our private lives too. And ultimately, that's about, you know, control over global infrastructure. And so when we look at this, we look at where we are now, just as social media was and iPhones were, smart glasses are now kind of the newest symptom of what happens when tech billionaires who care about money and political power and control want to surveil and use our data for the next part of their mission. So I think smart glasses are kind of revealing to us an attempted shift of the Overton window, if you will, so what's accepted or normal, to a place that I think a lot of Australians and a lot of regular people feel quite uncomfortable with.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this really makes me think about Pokemon Go, for example, as you know, this process of effectively data collection and spatial mapping that people were doing by playing this game. And it does make me wonder about, you know, the price point and broad accessibility of this technology and the sort of scale of surveillance that this enables and participation in these processes of data gathering, whether people are, you know, aware of it or not. Now, I wanted to ask you about some of the major privacy concerns here. I think they're worth rehashing. Can you talk us through those, especially when it comes to gendered risks?
Yeah, of course. And thank you for asking that question. When we look at smart glasses, I think it's also really important to say that, like, Meta are monopolizing the market here. So most of the data we have around the privacy concerns around smart glasses come from Meta glasses. And it's hard to separate the product from the company, right? Like, we know that right now Meta are facing $1.4 trillion in damages. There's been lawsuits around privacy concerns, like, a litany of them. But ultimately, privacy and data concerns are, like, central. So, you know, we know that people who are wearing these glasses are even concerned, even though they've bought them, around how their data is being used. So that is the metadata, so their location, where they are at any given time, their behavior, their choices, and then also the content that these glasses are capturing. So what is being filmed, what audio is being captured, and what photos are being taken are also being shared to a cloud and then used to train, which is widely reported in tech media, are being used to train Meta's learning models and also humanoid robots, which they're planning on releasing and making commercial. So there's that. There's the people wearing them are concerned about where their privacy and data is going. But then people who aren't wearing them, who have never even heard of the glasses, are also really concerned because at any moment you can be filmed without your consent in public at any time. And so this idea that we have a right to privacy, even though we're in a public place, which a lot of people, you know, would agree with, if you've ever shut a door or you've shut curtains in your house or you've been in the back of a photo and you've dodged out the way in public, that means that you care about privacy. What we're seeing is that kind of anyone now feels like they don't have a right to privacy in public because wearable tech is covertly filming at any given time. And the companies that create these glasses are saying, well, there's an indicator light on them, but I think we have to be really clear that indicator lights are not the same as consent.
Totally. And it's so insidious, right? Like, I think we've really, the sort of level of normalization of constant digital surveillance has gotten to the point where I suppose we're now supposed to accept the fact that it just may not be possible to tell when we are being surveilled. But I feel like the fact that, you know, you're pushing back against this and that there's been 54,000 signatures or more to your petition shows that even though we are aware that, you know, we might get captured in somebody's random TikTok or video that they're sending to their mum at any point in time filmed on a smartphone, this is another level of intervention, and it is something that people are not comfortable with.
Yeah, and you asked about the gender element before. Like, most of the pushback that has been building for a while now, actually, it's just that it's broken the mainstream now, which is why we're hearing more about it. But most of that pushback has been from women. When we look at the sales of smart glasses, we know that majority men buy them, and we know that women, marginalized people, vulnerable groups, parents particularly, are really, really uncomfortable with that Overton window shift that you're describing, because what we're seeing anecdotally, and there's research now happening into this, but we're always kind of behind the behaviour, is voyeurism and non-consensual videoing and sexual harassment, street harassment, online humiliation. We're seeing extortion, so women being videoed, finding themselves online, and then the creators extorting them for either sexual favours or money in order to take those down. We're seeing reports of men wearing them in beaches, on dates when women don't know, in gyms. We've got reports already of, because this is an inanimate object, if you think about glasses, you could pop your glasses on the side of your house and you just think there's some glasses there. We're seeing them being used as covert spyware as well. So I think, you know, the pushback's very valid, and I think people are very scared. And I think what we're seeing is what happens when you normalize covert surveillance in a society where misogyny and sexual violence is already endemic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is something that should be front of mind for people here in so-called Australia at the moment, especially with what has come out about the Sydney Swans and concerns about, you know, player behaviour there. It just goes to show, again, that this is a normalized part of our society. Misogyny is a normalized part of our society, and that if people are in positions where they feel like they are more readily able to take advantage of the gender distribution of power in society, who's to say that they won't do that? And as you say, people have been. Now, I do want to ask about the regulatory lag here in Australia regarding wearable surveillance technology, because, you know, it seems like an incredible oversight for these to even hit the shelves in the way that they have done. So what does privacy legislation say about these kinds of goods? What are the gaps?
It's incredibly murky. To give you context, previous campaign that I worked on in the UK, I'm British, as you can tell by my accent, I worked on bringing the Voyeurism Act in 2019, which was actually a law that criminalised upskirting. And when I was bringing that law in, the law was incredibly murky around that being a specific sexual offence. It wasn't a specific sexual offence at the time. Now, when we look at the law across Australia, obviously it's different between states and territories, but federally across the whole country, it's actually not regulated. It's largely unregulated for a person to film a person in public places for personal use. So these devices aren't specifically regulated, and they don't, the best way to describe it is that surveillance devices are quoted in the law, but whether smart glasses are seen as or treated as surveillance devices really depends on where they're used and how they're used. And we also have to be really real, right? Like, the law helps us after the fact, after the harm has already taken place. So although we need legal reform and we need legislative protections, And that is a really serious conversation that has to be happening here, because let's be real, they shouldn't be selling these glasses before the law has even caught up. We also need to be talking about a social and cultural pushback so that the only rights people have aren't just to use the law after harm has already occurred.
Yeah, that point about a social and cultural pushback is so important given the way that the law functions, because the last thing that you would want is to have, you know, a class action based on an instance of serious harm where that can't be taken back. You know, it is sort of incumbent on people to raise their voices about how this is an intrusive practice now. And on that point, I did want to ask if you've received any communication from the Kmart group regarding your petition.
We haven't. We haven't received any contact yet, but that's okay. That's part of campaigning. And we've got some quite interesting plans coming up, which I can't tell you about, but we will be demanding a response this week.
Yeah, well, I mean, I look forward to following those updates, but I did want to also ask you about, you know, this broader cultural question and, you know, get your thoughts as we move to closing about how you think society should be tackling this.
I think this is a great example of what happens when socially and culturally we make it incredibly clear what we're uncomfortable with, and then political will follows, right? Most campaigners who have worked politically to change laws or to work in reform will tell you that there's no way to do that unless the social and cultural pushback comes first. And so I think what happened with Google Glass 10 years ago, they released them, there was huge pushback, they pulled them. We've actually won before on this, and we forget that. And I think, you know, it's our job to say, no, actually, we're not comfortable with becoming surveillance actors for big tech. We're seeing a huge, huge pushback against data centers, against the AI boom overreaching into democracy. And so this is just another part of that. And I would just say to anyone listening who feels, you know, a sense of discomfort feels unsettled by this, use your voice, sign petitions, go to local meetups, have conversations about it. You're not alone in that. There is already millions of people who feel that way.
I think that is such a good point. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up, Gina?
I think there's one thing I would love to mention, which is that when we're talking about smart glasses, there's also valid uses for disabled communities. We've seen that disabled communities, blind people, low vision people, have been using them to navigate an ableist society. And when we talk about banning them, I think that brings up a lot of concern for disabled communities. I think it's really important to say that disabled people have figured out with their own ingenuity how to use them to navigate an ableist society, and Meta Glasses and these companies actually didn't know they were doing that. They put PR out after the fact. Sorry, I've got a cough.
No, you're
so,
right.
As we talk about banning them or legislating or restricting, we also need to be keeping disabled justice central to that and having conversations about, okay, how do we supply people with these if they're a really seriously useful accessibility need, while also making sure that we're not normalizing covert surveillance in the mainstream.
Yeah, that is such an important point, Gina. I really appreciate you bringing that up because, you know, even as we're thinking now about the cuts to the NDIS scheme and people being able to access things like, you know, accessibility technology, there is this other dimension. But as you emphasize, this is something that the companies found out after the fact and not something that these tools were explicitly created to do. So there is some nuance there, but definitely the privacy and surveillance concerns are front of mind.
Yeah, and especially just to know, especially when disabled people and disabled women face risks of violence in public and sexual harassment at much higher levels than women without disabilities, you know, which this technology facilitates. So like you say, lots of nuance to think about, but we can hold all of that at the same time and find solutions for everyone if that's what we want to do.
Absolutely. Well, Gina, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And that was multi-award-winning gender equality advocate, writer, and facilitator Gina Martin, who spoke with us about the privacy and gendered implications of a rise in wearable surveillance technology with a focus on Kmart's new Anko brand camera glasses. Now, as we discussed, Gina launched a petition demanding that the Kmart group remove these from store shelves, and it's now reached over 54,000 signatures. If you do want to sign that petition, we will have links in our show notes at 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast, where we do podcast the show after every week. And you can also head there to listen back to previous episodes of the program. And for now, we will take a quick break and come back to you with our next interview.
The blues is back, all right, and it's at the Fitzroy Bowls Club on Saturday, the 22nd of August. This is a 3CR fundraiser for the Blues with a Feeling program. In fact, we'll be doing a live broadcast. The feature artist is Ezra Lee and the Broken Blues Band. This is them. Remember, Saturday, August the 22nd, 7 p.m, $10 entry at the door at the Fitzroy Bowls Club, Brunswick Street, just near the Edinburgh Gardens. See you there.
I really enjoyed that promo, the blues, beautiful pizzazz of that promo. My filler words, I feel like I always get more and more inventive. Pizzazz is new though, so watch out, listeners, you're going to hear more pizzazz on the show. And if you're just joining us, we have been talking about the AI breakfast special this week, and you just heard from Gina Martin about the new Anko Kmart sunglasses and, yeah, the real safety risk and privacy risk about them. And now we are joined by Ben McLeod, who's a senior advisor at the Climate Council, who joins me to unpack how we can shield houses from the data center bills and pollution and real concerns around the sheer amount of electricity they use and the need for them to be powered with renewable energy. Otherwise, yeah, they will really push up people's electricity bills, and really talking about in the context of National and New South Wales guidelines. But thanks so much, Ben, for joining me here today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
No worries. Could you tell us more about the work that the Climate Council and yourself does?
Yeah, sure. So the Climate Council is a community-funded independent champion for climate solutions. Our work is evidence-led and really started in the climate science and remains, you know, with that at its foundation. And what we do on a day-to-day basis is look at the opportunities for Australia to do more to cut climate pollution, or in this case, avoid poor outcomes that would drive climate pollution up, with the ultimate goal of creating a safer future for all of our kids in a world that is heating up and a world that we need to, you know, cut climate pollution as quickly as possible to avoid further harm.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that a lot of people around me and people who are really, really seeing how rampant and almost fast-moving climate catastrophe basically is, and it's quite noticeable. And I guess what's happening with the New South Wales data centres and why is there the need to invest in renewable power?
Yeah, so data centres, as you sort of mentioned, have a real risk of pushing up our climate pollution and our power bills. The reason for that is that they are very energy intensive. They use a lot of power and they use it relatively constantly. And there's a huge number of data centres that are being proposed in Australia. So in New South Wales, there's about 44 data centres in the pipeline. In Victoria, there's about 30 data centres in the pipeline. And if all the data centres that are planned were built over the next sort of 4 years to 2030, the industry could be using as much electricity in Australia as every home in Victoria. So it's a really massive change to be building these data centres. And what we have seen in New South Wales is a response to, I think, widespread community and industry concern that these new data centres could be using the cheap renewable power that we need to power homes and industries that are already here. And the response was to say that those data centres should be required to bring their own renewable power, including wind, storage, solar, to make sure that those impacts are sheltered from households. And look, I think there's still some way to go, but the progress we're seeing on this in Australia at the moment, I think, is really hopeful. And governments are, I think, hearing the community expectation that they be sheltered from, you know, the potential downsides of the data center boom.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think going back to your previous comment about data centers, if all of them were built, did you say that they would use the same amount of electricity as every single home in Victoria?
Yeah, so about 6% of the electricity in our main national grid, which covers, you know, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, and so on, and equivalent to every home in Victoria, which, you know, is a huge amount of power.
Yes.
And we, you know, from a Victorian perspective, we'd be thinking, I'd like to keep powering homes, please.
Yes, yes, please. That would be the most important thing. And I'm really curious about the mandatory standards that the Climate Council is calling for to really ensure that, you know, a lot of these proposals that are falling short don't pass and the proposals are actually adequate.
Yeah, so look, I think we really welcome what was done in New South Wales to put some standards around renewable energy and other issues too. And it follows what we had called for earlier in the year, which was mandatory standards, particularly to support additional renewable energy build out so that they can be powered by those renewables. And we were also called for other issues around managing their water use so that it's as much as possible recycled water, not drawing on drinking water supplies, using sort of smart technology at data centres to make sure they can power up and down as we need them to. So, for example, perhaps on a very hot day when everyone's turning on their air conditioners, data centres would power down for some time to create space in the grid for that use. And that's, you know, a much more efficient way to use them. And then even just the basic level that these data centres pay for the infrastructure that they use, so the grid connections that they get, any further transmission lines that might need to be built to power them, water infrastructure. We're already quite far ahead in Australia of other jurisdictions like the US when it comes to this question, but it's really important that they're picking up the tab for all of the infrastructure that may need to be built to support them. So it's really a question of pay your own way, power yourself, and be a good contributor to the community, as opposed to the potential downsides that we're seeing in other nations that are a bit further ahead on this data center question than we are.
Yeah, so this might seem like a silly question, but with the data centers, if they are built, can they like divert away from the power line that households are on, or do they have to be on the same power line? Because that would clearly affect the neighbouring communities and everybody else. But, yeah, I'm just curious about how they even, like, do that day to day.
Yeah, I mean, they could be. They could be built off-grid and power themselves, I suppose, with their own solar, their own batteries. It's not necessarily a bad thing to have them on our own power grid in the sense that if they're building their own renewable power and storage, whether that be on the exact site or somewhere else in the state so that that's able to carry on the transmission line, that's still power that households and other industries can use. So it may not be a bad thing to have them contributing to the grid that we all share as long as they make a fair contribution. So really it's a matter of saying, will they be supporting the build-out of power generators, projects like wind farms and solar farms and batteries, as opposed to totally sequestering them away or separating them out from the power systems that we use.
Yeah, and specifically with data centres, is it like the generative AI boom or is it other organisations or that need places to house their data? I'm just like, what is happening in these data centres that I need so much goddamn energy all the time?
Absolutely. Look, it's definitely a bit of a mix. As everyone would know, I think we're using technology, the internet, sort of cloud computing, whether that be Google Drive or YouTube or anything, more often than we have in the past. So I think that is part of it. But really, the AI boom is the biggest driver of this at the moment and the reason why things have shifted quite so quickly. And the question is, for AI, not only hosting the products that we use, but potentially training those AIs. And that's a very energy-intensive process. And the more more data center capacity that an AI producer has, the better the models they are able to train and the more energy that that uses. And so that's really why we're seeing this massive drive in building out data centers quickly and much more power-hungry data centers than before. And so that's why it's so important, I think, for government to act quickly and get good rules in place before the current pipeline of projects gets to the point where governments need to make a decision on whether they're going to be allowed to go ahead or not.
Thank you so much for explaining that. I just wanted to clarify because, yeah, there's so much mishmash of what the data center boom is. But it's clear it's just like part of the technological advancement, but the AI boom is something to, yeah, really, really keep an eye on that we've spoken about in the show today. And I guess I'm really wondering what this means for household bills and about climate pollution with your work from the Climate Council.
Yeah, so what we've seen is that if the new renewables weren't built to support these data centres, it could have a really significant impact on power prices. By 2035, it could push power prices up in Victoria by 23% and a similar amount in New South Wales. So that's really a scenario where these data centres are built and powered by, you know, if they don't build their own new renewable power, they're very likely to be powered by gas. And gas is a very expensive form of electricity generation. And because, as I said earlier, they'll be sharing the same grid as us, which could go well or it could go badly.
Right.
In the case that it goes badly and they are not, you know, powering themselves with cheap renewable power that they are bringing onto the grid, then that's potentially the downside, is that it could push up power bills by almost close to a quarter.
Yeah, that's pretty devastating to hear, I guess, already in a cost of living crisis with more people struggling than ever and struggling just to pay their bills. And then for, this to happen and potentially increase, by 23%, is something that is like will be an ongoing fight and concern. But hopefully the guidelines and regulation and the work that the Climate Council is doing will really contribute to regulating some of that. How can we learn more about the fight for regulated standards and some of the campaigns from the Climate Council?
Yeah, so you can go to climatecouncil.org.au. We explain these concepts in a very approachable way because it is often so complicated, but it's really important that people have the information and understand issues like data centers, but also issues surrounding climate change more generally, whether that be the kind of hot summers that we're having or the challenges in the Northern Hemisphere and how that's related to climate change. So climatecouncil.org.au, we're continuing to campaign on data centres and speak to governments about why these rules are necessary. And, for example, it's great in New South Wales to see the guidelines that they've released, and we're suggesting that they should make them mandatory. And so I think there's ongoing sort of work to be done in getting these rules right in all jurisdictions in Australia, all states and territories. But we also know that the federal government is looking at putting in some national standards, and I think that's a really important change as well, to make sure that all states are on a level playing field and there's not a race to the bottom in sort of attracting data centres at any cost.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much, Ben, for really explaining that and going through what it means for households and for climate pollution, but also, what is being done to help, navigate some of those questions. But thanks, Ben, and hope you have a really good day.
Thanks. Lovely to chat. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Ben McLeod, who is a senior advisor at the Climate Council, who joined me to unpack how we need to shield houses from data center bills and climate pollution, concerns around the sheer amount of electricity that they will use and the real need for them to be powered by renewable energy. Otherwise, they will push up people's electricity bills. And we'll be right back with our next segment.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Yabuwa, Lubura, Lamane, Yabuwa,
transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Good morning. You are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855. And right now we are joined by Associate Professor of Social Work at ACU, Jessica Rule-Smith, who is a sovereign Wiradjuri Wambul woman from the Smith and McGuinness Wiradjuri Matriarchy. Now, her research work focuses on the embodiment of First Nations sovereignty and critical anti-colonial practice. Jess co-authored the groundbreaking 2024 book, The AI Revolution, Valuing Country, Culture and Community in a World of Algorithms. So today, Jess joins us to speak about some of the current harms of the AI transformation on country, climate and social justice, the issue of data sovereignty and ways in which we can reconceptualize AI using First Nations people's ways of knowing and being with technology. Jess, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yugamarang. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
So I thought we could begin by, could you sort of explain what some of the harms of the current AI transformation are on country, climate and social justice rights?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I just feel as kind of each day goes on and AI continues to transform and all other forms of technology, you know, continue to grow, so do those harms. And you know, I think when we're thinking about blackfellas in our communities, that core harm and how it impacts country, earth, climate, social justice is this, what some of us call a digital terra nullius. So, you know, just the way that British invaders claim that so-called Australia belonged to no one to justify an invasion, we see AI companies are scraping our photos, art, writing, cultural material, you know, as if it belongs to no one and taking it, right, without our consent and, you know, that compensation. And so we've got that on that kind of individual level, but then we see it on so many other levels as well, right? We see this, the human labour that's hidden inside artificial intelligence and other technology transformations. We know that culturally and racially marginalised communities across the world are completely exploited through slave labour to, you know, review the safety tests, say, of AI systems and you know, this digital sweatshop labour that's existed for a long time. When I kind of speak about the climate impacts as well and that impact on country, I think it's, you know, it's hard for us to forget about the impact of things like data centres, which use so much energy and produce so much heat and need a lot of water to function. And, you know, then we've got electric vehicle batteries that are, you know, lithium, cobalt, nickel and all those sorts of materials that are mined. And we're seeing extreme violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, where people are being exploited to mine this, the kind of tech advancement elsewhere. And then, you know, it's technology and artificial intelligence is being used by settler colony states to inflict genocide and violence across the world. So we're seeing this impact on justice, country, earth, everything, and not just now, but for our future generations.
Like a myriad of issues, that are coming up out of this AI transformation. And I like that you touched on digital terra nullius. And I was wondering if you could unpack for us, your work focuses on an intersection between Indigenous sovereignty and AI. So what does data sovereignty look like under current AI models? And who is benefiting from current AI models in terms of data sovereignty and who isn't?
Yeah, and that framing is so spot on, isn't it? It's you know, I don't believe that technology is all bad, but I definitely don't think that it's neutral, and this is where our data sovereignty or Indigenous data sovereignty really plays an important role in how we understand, you know, technology, how it's developed, how it's used. So data sovereignty generally refers to the right of First Nations communities and nations to control data about us, how it's collected, access to it, how it's used, rather than that kind of ownership or control defaulting to, say, a government or, like, say a company. And this is where First Nations governance models are really important, because they centre ideas of ethics and care and country in that, as opposed to, you know, finances or data as power. There's some really fantastic models out there. The CARE principles, the OCAP principles, an incredible model from Aotearoa, the Māori AI governance framework here in so-called Australia. You know, First Nations communities are developing their systems of AI governance or other forms of data governance in terms of, you know, not just the data it produces, but also how is it produced, who holds it, and also, you know, what costs is there to country in that data production storage
And in the past, I've spoken with a mixed tech academic who focuses on, you know, the intersection between data sovereignty and digital decoloniality, and they've raised, you know, the potential perhaps for big corporations to be able to access data of activists who are pushing for further First Nations rights and using that, you know, in an adverse way against these activists. And I'm just wondering if you think that that's a potential, you know, scenario that could happen within so-called Australia.
Absolutely, and not potential. You know, it's active. If we look at different states and territories in Australia, you know, changes around activism laws. You know, I think it's AI can be used to identify and target people, absolutely. But also when we look at that, that doesn't occur in a vacuum, right? It's a coordinated response of power where laws are also being made to enable that to be enacted, to be protected, right? So it's not kind of happening over here or out there. It's here, and it's all through our society, and it's, you know, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Really is. I guess, you know, on a bit of a more positive note, you've previously written about the Indigenous AI Abundant Intelligences Research Program as an initiative working towards recognizing, and I'm quoting here, the abundant multiplicity of ways of being intelligent in the world. And that just really struck a note with me. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this program and perhaps the types of intelligence that are taken into consideration by this quote of a multiplicity of ways of being intelligent in the world.
Yes, absolutely. And the that's an international Indigenous-led research program and one that I look to a lot and take inspiration from, which organises and approaches this kind of reclamation of data, artificial intelligence, from programmer level to a kind of governance level that is grounded in Indigenous ways, through Indigenous perspectives of technical problems, technical evolution, and weaving Indigenous knowledges not just into that practice, but having it grounded in that. And, you know, the Māori AI plan that was released last year as well connects really closely with the Abundance Intelligence Project. Mm. And you know, I think what's important about all of those is that they're connected to a context, and that's to place and to country. Mm. One of the challenges we see, I think, particularly in AI, I don't know, maybe attempts to regulation, I don't know if it's ever fully committed to, but is this idea of some sort of one-size-fits-all legislation or governance or kind of principle that people will just somehow magically enact is going to happen, when that's not how the world functions. And this is where, when we talk about a multiplicity of ways of knowing, there are many cultures and ways of being in the world that exist. But First Nations cultures are the oldest living, surviving culture of the world that is connected to the land. But also our approaches is a way of celebrating different ways of knowing and different ways of being intelligent, that that's not just a uni degree or a tech program, right? That every single person has value, every single person has intelligence, and all of that needs to be valued when we think about AI or any form of tech.
And drawing upon, I guess, multiple ways of being intelligent and sort of trying to implement that in the way that we approach AI. You are a proud sovereign Wiradjuri Wambal woman and have drawn from Wiradjuri cosmology in your work to sort of reconceptualize how we can think about AI. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe to us how this can enhance our understanding of AI and its impacts.
Yes, and this is where, you know, again, it connects to what we were just talking about, you know, coming to the local, the context, the land. I'm very fortunate. I grew up on country. I learnt from my grandma, I learnt from my family, and we have some incredible elders in our community, including Uncle Stan Grant, who I was fortunate to do his language course on, and senior Wiradjuri elder Aunty Maria Williams, who I'm very honoured to work alongside and learn from. And my whole life learning from these people, or growing up with my nan and learning about Wiradjuri ways of knowing, and our concept of Wayana, which means kind of loosely translated to transformation, but is deeper than that. This idea that nothing simply ends or simply just starts. It transforms, right? It's always in some sort of evolution. And this is how, and Michelle and I talk about it in the book, but it's how we approach AI as well. It's not this tech that came out of nowhere. It's as connected to the railway, to the smartphone, to the axe, evolutions of technology as a tool that humans have used over time, but particularly when we think about transformation through a Wiradjuri way, it's all about understanding that everything is related and relationality. So what I take and what I've been guided through from my culture is that my relationship with AI, you know, it is a being, it's something I am in relationship to, something I'm in relationship with as well. So I need to make sure that the way that I use it is drawing on those principles and ways of knowing to be respectful and care for country as well.
And there's something really comforting, I think, in the idea that, you know, something exists, but it never stops existing. It never started existing. It's always been, and it can always be changed. I think, you know, nothing is set in stone, nothing's set in concrete. I find that to be quite comforting as well in how we can approach all matters. Particularly AI, it's not too late to, you know, set it in a good direction.
Absolutely. And you know, part of understanding transformation or Wayana is that we kind of have this, I guess another way of saying it would be like past, present and future all in one, right? Where we're in one kind of state or season, but that is a pre-state of the next transformation and the post of the one before. So it continuously evolves, but we also have power in what that next transformation looks like. And you know, when we look at the unceded and continuing sovereignty, the strength, the love that Blackfellas have for our communities and for our cultures, that is the answer in the heart of what needs to drive this next transformation of technology and how we use it.
And really incites a lot of hope, you know, for the future. And speaking of the future, I thought as we wrap up, now in your work, you've spoken about centering First Nations ways of knowing and being with technology into the AI transformation. So how can First Nations people's long history of interactions with technology help to inform the current AI transformation? And how could this help us build in a more humane way into the future?
Yeah, it's such an important question, and I feel perhaps one that gets floated around at like a word or a buzzword level, but perhaps not enacted. This is where we really need to connect and support nation building, First Nations. We are nations, you know, we are people. I'm Wiradjuri. There's different nations around. Those nations and the leaders, the elders, They are who companies and communities need to be working with to be guided by. What does that look like? What is the law and value of that country, of that nation, of that place? So that whether it's a policy, a legislation, coding, and any part of kind of technology, that it's connected to the culture and the values of that place and that land. You know, we're seeing more and more Indigenous roles on ethics boards or being looped in on AI projects. But if it doesn't start from First Nations views, from our ways of knowing first, it just continues to be this tack on. But when we actually start with blackfellas and our ways of knowing, everything shifts so significantly and powerfully. But that also requires us to slow down in a fast world, and technology is fast, but to connect with community first, not later. You know, it's not how can community help me, it's more what is my role to community.
Very powerful. And before we did wrap up, Jess, I was wondering, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that we have not yet?
I think just, you know, always stay critical with AI or any form of tech. I think for me, one of the parts of this that frustrates me and, you know, kind of concerns me is this, we can very easily use AI as the fall person, that it's, again, it's out there, you know, but it is, we made it, you know. The problems of artificial intelligence are because humans made it, or particular groups of humans or colonies, you know, lead it or lead its implementation. The colony and the man behind the curtain cannot be forgotten, and we need to remember that in any engagement with technology.
Yeah, it was not created in a social vacuum.
That's it.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Jess. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you, and we just can't thank you enough.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye. And that was Associate Professor of Social Work at ACU, Jessica Rule-Smith, a Sovereign Wiradjuri Wambul woman from the Smith and McGuinness Wiradjuri Matriarchy, whose work focuses on the embodiment of First Nations sovereignty and critical anti-colonial justice. Now, Jess co-authored the groundbreaking 2024 book, The AI Revolution, Valuing Country, Culture and Community in a World of Algorithms. And we will have a link to this book in our show notes that we provide at the end of the show. And it's an open access book if anyone is wanting to have a read.
And now for something we haven't done in a little while on the show is play a song to ease you into your morning. We're going to play Drifting Cows by Yu Powei. And that was Drifting Clouds, Boya Boya, an incredible, incredible band. And please listen to their latest song too, Rondra, which is came out in May. But
yeah, so I wanted to just briefly touch on something very significant that happened this week. And the connection is through the fact that Drifting Clouds frontman Terry Guyola is a Yolngu man. And you know, there has been quite a significant decision made by Northern Territory independent member of the Legislative Assembly, who is also a Yolngu man, Yinya Guyula, who resigned as the member for Mulka effective immediately, in a statement this week saying that he could no longer, quote, sit opposite a government who are not willing to listen or form partnerships, end quote. And really raised concerns about dehumanizing and oppressive laws by the Northern Territory government. So, you know, Mr. Guyula has received tribute from fellow politicians and First Nations folks from around the country, and we want to add our voices to that. It is, you know, extremely concerning to see what has been happening in the Northern Territory and to see that Mr. Guyula finds himself in a position where, as a member of the Legislative Assembly, he's no longer able to put his concerns forward in the face of, you know, racist conservatism of the country Liberal Party is just an absolute shame and an indictment on this country. Now, we want to give you a quick rundown of what we did cover today. Kate, take it away.
Okay, so to begin with, we listened to part one of a six-part project being developed by two of our very own 3CR hosts, which we will divulge more details later. It was based upon Radical Literature's A Booklet About Artificial Intelligence, which was written by the AI Safety Symposium. And it was a deep dive into the question of what is AI, to the extent that we're able to answer that right now.
And then after that, we heard from Gina Martin, a award-winning gender equality advocate, writer, and facilitator, who spoke with us about privacy and gendered implications of a rise in wearable surveillance technology, including Kmart's new Anko brand camera glasses, which sold out almost immediately once they hit shelves. Gina has started a very successful petition pushing back against the selling of these glasses, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
Yeah, amazing. And then we spoke with Ben McLeod, who's a senior advisor at the Climate Council, who joined me to discuss how we really need to shield data centers, shield households from data center bills and pollution, and real concerns around the sheer amount of electricity that they use and the need for them to be powered by renewable energy. Otherwise, they'll push up people's electricity bills, particularly if they are on our same power grid. And Ben was also talking about if that is not remedied or they don't bring their renewable energy, they'll use the same amount of energy as every single household in Victoria, which is wild, entire state. Yeah.
Not a small sum. Finally, we spoke with Associate Professor of Social Work at ACU, Jessica Rule-Smith, a Sovereign Wiradjuri Wambul woman from the Smith and McGuinness Wiradjuri Matriarchy, whose work focuses on the embodiment of First Nation sovereignty and critical anti-colonial practice. Jess spoke with us about the current harms of the AI transformation on country, climate and social justice, the issue of data sovereignty, and ways in which we can reconceptualize AI using First Nations people's ways of knowing and being with technology. We also spoke a little bit about the book that she released in 2024, co-authored, called The AI Revolution, Valuing Country, Culture and Community in a World of Algorithms, and we will have a link to that open access book in our show notes.
Yeah, Rizzi, and I did just want to plug that at Little Homie Cafe on Saturday the 29th and Sunday the 30th of August, there'll be a non-aligned books pop-up from 10 to 3 p.m. So that's 46 Trackford Street, Little Homie. And yeah, that will be really, really amazing. And on the Friday, the 28th, there is a performance night and open mic from Manash Afro Society and Melbourne Uni Black Collective, a benefit concert for Sudan, and that is from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. And we really want to thank everybody for joining us here today to really talk about the importance of AI. We've really covered it from different angles, but really grounding it in First Nation sovereignty from like Kate's final interview. Mm. And we really hope that you enjoyed listening to us today, and we will catch you next time.
Yes, take care.
Bye.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.